Search teams continue to look for survivors in eastern Alabama after those powerful tornadoes killed at least 23 people. In a news conference today, Lee County Coroner Bill Harris said the victims ranged from 6 to 93 years old.
Just keep those families in your prayers. There's one family in there, they're connected, and there are over 7 people this man lost in one family.
7 in one family. Well, our next guest says this tragedy highlights a unique vulnerability in the South. Victor Gensini is a tornado researcher at Northern Illinois University. And Victor, you were watching radar tracking of these tornadoes. What were you thinking as you watched?
Well, honestly, your stomach gets heavy and you know as a researcher what's happening at the surface.
Yeah. Well, and as you point out, storm prediction centers had outlooks 4 to 5 days in advance. Tornado watches were issued. People like you around the country were seeing this. What's the disconnect? Why did so many people die, in your opinion?
And I think it comes to the unique question of exposure and vulnerability. Mm-hmm. We have a big challenge in the southeastern United States as we have a lot of trees in the way. It makes seeing tornadoes very hard. We have another big problem, though, and that's we have a lot of mobile homes. And if you're in a mobile home, when a tornado strikes, you're very likely to be injured or perhaps even killed. My colleague here at Northern Illinois, Walker Ashley, and I have another colleague, Stephen Schrader at Villanova University, have looked a lot at mobile homes. And what we generally see is over half of all tornado fatalities occur in mobile homes, and yet they only account for roughly 7% or so of the United States housing stock. So we have this disparity where a lot of folks are getting injured or killed in mobile homes. And so we ought to start thinking of, you know, potential, whether it's legislation or some mandates, to require these mobile home parks to have safe shelters nearby so these people have access to safety. But that only really, I think, addresses one issue of the problem. The second issue is we're making really good forecasts, but are people actually getting the warning? And if they do get the warning, are they actually willing and able to take action? And that's another thing that, you know, if you think forecasting the weather is hard, forecasting human behavior is sometimes even harder.
Well, let's talk about that, because Ari Gerstmann, who's with the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, very bluntly said, maybe we need more funding for social science to actually figure out the psychology of people, because the messages are going out and some people complain. I don't want that interrupting my television show.
I couldn't agree more. We absolutely need more research on how people respond to our watches, our warnings, and even our severe weather outlooks. Again, the science is getting very, very good at predicting at least general locations of where severe weather is likely, but we still have this disconnect, as we saw a couple days ago. You know, people's lives in those regions, especially in Lee County, Alabama, will never be the same.
Well, and we're certainly not blaming the victims. We're trying to figure out a way to get that message across. So there's that. But we've also been hearing today the concern that, and it's not even tornado season yet. Some have mentioned that April that's coming up may be even worse. What do you say to that?
I am always very careful to use the two terms, tornado alley and tornado season, because I think when you use those terms, you lead people to believe that severe weather is only going to happen or is only likely to happen in a certain area of the country or at a certain time of the year. And as a researcher, I know that that's not true. Tornadoes happen in all 50 states and they can happen any time of the year. And while the southeastern United States doesn't have a focused tornado season, they have a very broad risk over the entire year. And that means you can never really let your guard down for these events. Yeah. And if you do, you become complacent to the hazard. And unfortunately, if you become complacent, you may become of the sort of mindset that, you know, these are not events that are going to happen to me and I shouldn't worry about it when they issue a watch or a warning. And unfortunately, it just takes one tornado to really, you know, produce what we saw a couple days ago.
Victor, we are hearing terrible stories out of Alabama. A parent holding a 6-year-old son who was just ripped from his arms because of the strength of the wind. Another man, they were hiding in the basement, and the dog got very quiet. So he went up to see, he opened the door, and almost was vacuumed out with the force of these winds.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, until mobile homes in particular get more shelters, what should a person do if they find themselves suddenly there they are and the tornado's coming? Hit the floor, get under something? I mean, what can you do?
Well, you can't wait until the house is collapsing on you to try to think about what to do, you know. But if you're in a tornado warning and you do think that your property or your life is in jeopardy, you really need to get indoors, get to the lowest floor, and put as many walls between you and the tornado as possible. You know, I'm telling even people now to, in your emergency kit, put a bike helmet in there, because a lot of the injuries that we see are blunt force trauma to the head. And, you know, I think a bike helmet could actually go a long way in your emergency disaster kit when you're thinking about severe storms.
Done. Victor Gensini, tornado researcher at Northern Illinois University, in the sad, terrible aftermath of the tornado in Lee County. Victor, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, the actor Luke Perry is being remembered today by many other Hollywood stars who worked with him over the years. He was most famous for his role on Beverly Hills 90210. Perry died yesterday after suffering a massive stroke a few days earlier. The CDC identifies stroke as the fifth leading cause of death for Americans, with about 140,000 dying from strokes each year. And joining us now is Dr. Mona Bay-Huth, who is assistant professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Doctor, welcome. And let's start with the basics. What is a stroke and what causes it?
So a stroke is caused by any disruption of blood flow to the brain. The brain is the only organ in the body that is reliant on a constant flow of oxygen and nutrients to keep the cells of the brain functioning. So a stroke can really happen in two different ways. One is when the blood vessel gets blocked, therefore reducing blood flow to the brain by an occlusion or a blockage of the blood vessel. The other way a stroke happens is the bleeding kind of stroke, a hemorrhagic stroke, when the blood vessel itself breaks open and blood leaks out, injuring the brain tissue around it.
And the fact that Luke Perry was just 52 years old, is that unusual for somebody to have a stroke, a fatal stroke, at such a young age?
Yeah, you know, stroke definitely increases with each decade of life above age 55, but it's not uncommon for young patients to have stroke. So probably on the order of 10 to 15% of stroke patients are really under the age of 55.
And are certain people more at risk than others?
There are definitely risk factors that put people at risk for a stroke. Some of those risk factors include high blood pressure, smoking, atrial fibrillation, a condition where the heart beats irregularly and increases the risk for sending a blood clot from the heart to the brain, high cholesterol, poor diet, and lack of exercise. Some of those will put you at much higher risk for stroke. There are genetic and family causes, but those are much fewer and far between.
And how likely are you to die from a stroke? Or if you do survive one, what is life like afterwards?
You know, we've really made great gains in how in the United States we've helped patients to survive through the stroke. Stroke used to be the number two leading cause of death in the United States and now is down to the fifth leading cause of death. That said, probably between 10 and 15% of stroke patients will die from the stroke. That really depends on the type of stroke that the patient is having and the size of the area of brain tissue that is affected by the stroke. So the larger the area of stroke, the larger the area of damage of the brain, the more chance for death. Equally, some of the hemorrhagic stroke types have an increased likelihood of death depending on the cause of the hemorrhagic stroke.
And then what is life like afterwards for people who've survived a stroke?
Once you've survived the first few days after a stroke, all efforts really turn to helping you recover from that stroke. So unfortunately, although we've improved survival from stroke, we haven't really moved the needle on the level of disability that stroke leaves people with once they've experienced it. So the patients who have strokes can have physical abnormalities, meaning some patients can't walk, some cannot move their arms to take care of themselves, including activities of daily living. Some strokes steal people's ability to talk or communicate, and that can mean affect the ability for the words to come out properly or even the ability to understand the spoken word to them. Some strokes steal the person's ability to see completely, so some stroke patients will have a loss of vision in one part of their vision. Different types of strokes may cause trouble with balance. And so while people do recover from stroke and can get back to meaningful life, there are a lot of stroke-related disabilities that persist when you can survive the first few days of stroke.
What are the warning signs for people? I know that there's an acronym called FAST that people should follow when they're trying to identify if a stroke is occurring and what to do about it.
Yeah, it's really critical that people know the signs and symptoms of stroke. Now, the FAST acronym is really great because it encourages people to remember that this painless process, you should respond quickly. And FAST stands for face weakness. So if you see somebody whose face is drooping on one side, that could be the sign of a stroke. A stands for arm weakness. So if somebody who was previously moving their arms well suddenly has weakness in one arm, that could be a sign of the stroke. S stands for speech, so if you notice that someone is having trouble talking or understanding the spoken word all of a sudden. And T means time. Time is of the essence. When you have an ischemic stroke or the stroke that is caused by a blockage of a blood vessel, we have a very narrow time window for which treatments can be rendered. So calling 911 and getting to the hospital as quickly as possible is essential.
That is Dr. Mona Bay-Huth, who's an assistant professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, talking with us about strokes after Luke Perry died yesterday following a massive stroke just a few days earlier. Doctor, thank you.
Well, thank you.
In 2003, fine art photographer Kevin Bubrisky was on assignment in a peaceful Syria to take pictures of places like the ancient Souk in Aleppo, a center of commerce for some 2,000 years, and people like the small boy hugging the long-haired sheep he was tending. This was 8 years away from the uprising, then civil war, then proxy war and battle against ISIS that would kill 400,000 people, force 12 million more to flee, and reduce much of Syria to rubble. In 2014, we spoke with Syrian scholar Amr al-Azm about the archaeological losses.
I've just seen photographs from a site close to Raqqa, large trenches dug up with these bucket diggers, you know, and the damage is phenomenal, and it's gone forever. It can never be returned or retrieved.
Well, now, Azam has written the foreword to a book of Kevin Bubrisky's photographs from 2003, Legacy in Stone, Syria Before War. We start our conversation with Kevin Bubrisky, who's at WAMC in Albany, New York. Kevin, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
Describe the Syria you visited.
My writer friend Lou Werner and I, we arrived at night in Damascus, and it was October of 2003. The American war in Iraq was 6 months old, and our intention was to visit Syria because of the proximity of the war and to tell a story of some sort of the deep history and the living culture of Syria. And so we ended up on our way to Aleppo to do photographic portraits and then the stories of the people who live and work in the souk, selling olive oil, soap, wedding dresses, spices. It was an incredible, endless labyrinth of alleyways, vaulted archways.
We'll have pictures at herenow.org, but does it still exist?
As the war started in 2011, there were street battles throughout Aleppo, and the souk became a hot point of the conflict, fires, and then bombardment as well.
As you page through the book, some of these beautiful columns, these arches, how did those stones hold up? Are they gone?
Everything has been damaged to some extent. Some things have been entirely destroyed. There are remnants that are still there, but it's very hard to know exactly what's left. ISIS had occupied the ancient city of Palmyra for 2 years. They used the beautiful old Roman theater as a backdrop for mass executions. They blew up and totally destroyed the magnificent monumental arch. The incredible, immense Temple of Bel was also thoroughly destroyed. This was a direct assault on the cultural history of place and also the multi-ethnic cultural histories, because there were the ancient Romans and the early Christians and the Byzantine world followed by the early Islamic world. And all of that was targeted by ISIS and others.
What were you thinking when years later, you were there in 2003, and when years later you're watching the news and you're hearing that ISIS is, as you said, in Palmyra. Palmyra is a town known historically for its role on the Silk Route, servicing caravans. What was it like for you?
Very disturbing. It's very hard to see the unravelment of places that have been somewhat stable for such a long time. I mean, in 2003, Lou Werner and I went to Syria. We didn't have the idea of a big story. We just wanted to be in touch with people that were there to show that people were having regular lives. And then I realized, I'm in Syria now. I've got to take my time and get out to what are called the Dead Cities. In 2003, you could go through that area and just come upon these glorious abandoned, roofless limestone structures, 2-3 stories tall, with the beautiful carved rock. So as a photographer, I was just taken with that, the interplay of light and shape and stone.
We're looking at some of them, and again, we'll have them at herenow.org, but there's San Simeon, which is part of the Dead Cities. There's a church there built to glorify this relatively new faith of Christianity in the year 459. Beautiful pictures of these. They look like very crude crosses. Do you want to go back?
Of course I want to go back. But I also know the dangers, all the IEDs, all the unexploded explosive devices, and then also all the political difficulties of being an American going into a place like Syria. Mm. So at some point, yes, I would love to go back.
Well, meanwhile, I'm looking at one of the pictures. This is a souk in Aleppo, and you see a huge stone wall on the left, and along it rows and rows and rows on little plastic hangers of babies' outfits, little onesies. Some gentlemen with leather jackets who look like they could be walking down a fancy street in Italy, a woman covered head to toe. You've done all of this in black and white, and they do feel like ghosts.
These photographs go from 2003, but my wife and I were in Syria in 2009, and going into the Umayyad Mosque of Damascus in 2009 was like being in the Piazza San Marco in Venice. It was just a collection of people from all over the world. There was no sense of division or discrimination. And so that's also an image I like to keep with me. I don't think of my images as ghosts. I think of them as a testament to the resilience of culture. And so I think we have to believe that there's going to be a future for Syria, for their people, for the cultural legacy as well. I'm not seeing the images as ghosts, but as solid factual evidence of what Syria can rebuild itself toward.
That's photographer Kevin Bubrisky. His new book, Pictures Taken in Syria in 2003, Legacy in Stone, Syria Before War. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Well, now let's bring in Amr Al-Azam again. He's professor of Middle East History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio. As we mentioned, we spoke with him in 2014 about the archaeological losses in his country, Syria. And now he's written the introduction to Kevin Bubrisky's book. And Professor, your thoughts when you first saw these pre-war pictures, do they look like ghosts to you?
No. I mean, for me, it was almost like jumping on these photos and thinking, oh my God, thank God somebody's recorded this, because this is all that we have left. The original monuments themselves, whether it's the old souks of Aleppo or the Temple of Bel in Palmyra and other such monuments, were now destroyed or just damaged beyond repair. So having these fabulous, beautiful photographs really then, for me, became almost like a beacon of hope that future generations will still be able to see what I had seen with my own eyes, at least, and still marvel at their beauty.
I'm surprised that you are as hopeful as you are seeing the photographs, because you said to us that without this tangible proof of the past, which is now mostly rubble, there is no future Syria. You have to have it for a Syria to rise from these ashes, a cultural heritage derived from a common shared history is critical to establish a Syrian identity that takes no account of ethnic or sectarian or tribal differences.
Yes, indeed. But Syria is very fortunate in that it is an extremely rich region in terms of the amount of cultural heritage that we have. So even as we have lost such amazing, beautiful sites and monuments, there is still a huge amount left. My concern is that our ability to then make sure that future generations can see, feel, and experience the same things that we have in, if not the same way, in a just as equally meaningful manner.
Yeah. You were also, when we spoke with you, fighting for a UN resolution to ban the trading of some of these items. You also spoke of volunteers who were protecting, for instance, mosaics on the floors by sandbagging.
What's become even more of a problem for us is not just that the looting is happening and the sale, but look at the way in which social media platforms like Facebook, like WhatsApp, these are one of the primary ways in which looters and would-be terrorist organizations and would-be buyers are interacting on the same pages. Yesterday, I was just looking at a page, one page out of 50, 60 pages at least that I've been able to identify, where there are over 80,000 members of this page. And the page specifically is set up to invite people to basically show their goods. And if a sale occurs, you promise to pay a dividend or something to the organizers of the page. Hmm.
But have you been able to get any kind of resolution banning that?
There are several, you know, we've had bills passed here in the, the House. There are international laws that try to restrict the trade. You know, a lot of our work is campaigning to raise awareness about the danger of buying or dealing or trading in looted antiquities. Just at the very least warning the general public that when you buy an antiquity, just make sure, not just that it's authentic or fake, but that also it's not looted recently, that some terrorist has not just made a lot of money thanks to the fact that you've just bought this.
Professor, back to the photographs. I can't imagine. I'm trying to think what it would be like to have Mount Rushmore completely toppled and destroyed. What's it like for you to linger over these photographs?
You know, photographs can be very beautiful, but there is something about being there. If you think of the Temple of Bel, for example, one of the features of the Temple of Bel is that you go early in the morning just as the sun is beginning to rise, and the temple itself is quite dark. But as the sun rises from the east, it climbs slowly, and at one moment it will hit those windows and the room will explode with light. Blinding light. That sensation of light, that feeling, you can never recreate that in an image. And what really, really breaks my heart is that, you know, future generations of young Syrians, including my own daughters, will never be able to experience this. They will look at the pictures, they'll read about it, sure, but they will never be able to experience that feeling, that sensation of that light exploding just as the sun hits those windows.
That's Amr al-Azam, professor of Middle East history and anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, to see the beautiful pictures from Kevin's book, Syria Before War, go to hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
As the 2020 presidential campaign gets underway, major donors are deciding where to put their money. That includes big tech companies like Google, Apple, and Facebook, which all spent millions during the 2016 campaign. But after so many scandals over privacy and election meddling, Silicon Valley's reputation is not what it was, and donations could be a liability. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Teddy Schleifer is senior editor at Recode. Hi, Teddy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So it's early yet, but how has Silicon Valley already been weighing in? Do they have a preferred candidate?
You know, I spent the last couple of weeks talking with a ton of big Democratic donors, Democratic fundraisers. And, you know, I think that in some ways, this is kind of the opposite of the 2016 campaign for Republicans, where you saw a lot of energy early behind Jeb Bush. Here in 2020, we have a similarly sized Democratic field, but there's no early money moving very quickly. You get the sense from talking to some Democratic donors, Democratic campaigns, that Silicon Valley money isn't really what it used to be, right? I mean, take someone like Sheryl Sandberg, big Democratic donor in the past, obviously extremely influential household name. Would a Democratic candidate want Sheryl Sandberg on their FEC filings anymore?
Well, because of all the problems she had at Facebook,
sure.
Even though she is the lean-in author, she wasn't very transparent about some of the company's activities.
Right. And I think, you know, that just speaks to the broader issue here of, like, Silicon Valley donors and Silicon Valley marquee names will raise questions about, are you too close with Silicon Valley? And I think a great example of that is Cory Booker, the New Jersey senator and kind of a, you know, a mid-level Democratic candidate right now. Long close with lots of important people in Silicon Valley. He's going to have to answer questions throughout this campaign about, is he too close to big tech?
Right, and he might be asked those questions by other Democratic candidates in the debates.
Totally.
You know, one activist you spoke with called the tech industry our generation's big tobacco, not
right.
just for these scandals, but, you know, there are people questioning whether a lot of the technology that we're living with is good for our health. So there's a divide there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this was a, you know, an activist asked by Cory Booker, you know, he felt that he was, you know, a Manchurian candidate for Silicon Valley.
Hmm.
And, you know, Booker might be at one end of the spectrum. You know, you have other candidates like Amy Klobuchar, the Minnesota senator, who's actually been pretty tough on big tech, but even she's coming here to San Francisco in a couple weeks for a fundraiser, according to an invitation that we've seen. So even if you are, you know, very strident in your opposition to tech and have a lot of criticisms of it, a reality of Democratic politics is that this is where the money is. So you got to show up.
Well, and just briefly, because there's just one candidate right now on the Republican side, but last week, the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, had Senator Josh Hawley, the Missouri Republican, hosting a panel blasting Facebook and Google and Twitter for what he called a left-wing social agenda. Last year, you know, at the same event, you had Facebook and Google with product demos and open bar events to woo conservatives. So Silicon Valley seems to be having a, you know, a breakup with the right.
Right. And with the left. Right. That's the challenge. That's the challenge for the Valley right now is there's, you know, they used to have some comfort with Republicans because they're free market big companies that have produced a ton of innovation. They used to have comfort kind of with the left culturally, right, because of their progressivism on social issues. And now you get the sense the Valley has really no political allies.
That's Teddy Schleifer, senior editor for finance and influence at Recode. Teddy, thank you.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Did you use shampoo this morning? If you did, it probably lives in a plastic container that you'll discard when it's done. What about your ice cream? That's probably in a container that you'll eventually throw out. Which brings us to a new idea to get products like that into containers that you'll put out on the porch after use so they can be refilled. The company that wants to do this is called Loop, and it's already got buy-in from Nestle, Unilever, and Procter & Gamble. Loop is the brainchild of Tom Zaki, the CEO of the recycling firm TerraCycle. He joins us as part of our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top. Tom, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And tell us first about how this would work exactly.
Well, the idea of Loop is to solve waste at the root cause, which we, you know, we think really is this idea of using something once or disposability. And so the general idea with Loop is that instead of the consumer owning their packages at the end when they're empty, it's always owned by the manufacturer. And so instead of it going to waste or recycling, we simply pick it back up from the consumer, clean it, and around it goes again. You know, sort of like the way milk used to be delivered back in the 1950s.
And in some places still is. But are we talking about, in addition to ice cream and shampoo, what else?
Well, the idea is to bring this reuse model to absolutely everything, from your laundry detergent to your mouthwash, you know, from your orange juice to your granola. I mean, truly everything, in partnership with the world's biggest manufacturers to really try to shift consumption from a disposable system to a circular one.
Who comes in, picks it up, and drops it off?
However you normally buy your products today, whether on e-commerce or whether in store, it would happen the same. So if you buy online, you can access Loop, say, from loopstore.com or other places. It's delivered to you, say, by UPS, and then it's picked up by those same delivery vehicles. In store versions, you buy it at the store and then take it back to the store.
Now, as you know, when you buy something at the supermarket right now, almost everything has a seal on it so that you know it hasn't been opened before. Would you be able to do that with a container that's being reused over and over again?
This is a really good question. You know, a lot of these things that have been, you know, really thought about in design, really from a disposable perspective, have to be re-engineered when you think about it from a durable point of view. So, you know, when you get your delivery case, you know, instead of there being tape, there's a zipper. So we need to put a little latch on the zipper to make sure, you know, no one in the transportation has tampered with what's inside. Then for the products themselves, in beverages, some caps will give a little click sound when they open, so you know that no one's tampered with it. But there's a lot of innovation we have to do here to make sure that that type of work can go to any type of container.
Now, how did you get Nestle and Unilever to go along with this idea? Because they're part of the beta testing here.
That's right. And it's, you know, what I'm really thrilled with is, you know, beyond Nestle, Unilever, you know, it's P&G, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Mondelez. I mean, the list just goes on to most of the world's biggest producers. And what got these major companies excited is that Loop doesn't just solve for the idea of waste, but it also enables them to bring out innovation that they've always dreamed about, but simply couldn't in packaging that is owned by the consumer. So let's take, for example, the Nestle Häagen-Dazs ice cream container. So today, ice cream comes to us basically in coated paper. It's the same thing as a coffee cup. And it's generally unfunctional and also not recyclable in most recycling systems. The new Häagen-Dazs container is double-wall stainless steel. So it's an elevation of design. It's like the most beautiful ice cream package out there. But it also, because of its double-wall nature, keeps your ice cream frozen for multiple hours on the go. So if you take it out of the freezer, it'll look beautiful on the kitchen table, and you can have it out there for the whole dinner, and it won't melt. Now, that may seem like a trite, you know, innovation, but in the world of ice cream, that's quite game-changing.
Now, I imagine another upside for the companies that are involved in this is that it kind of locks consumers into a specific brand, because if you're going to be using this container over and over again and it's Häagen-Dazs ice cream, then you will send it away and come back with more Häagen-Dazs. You're not going to switch over to Ben & Jerry's in the meantime.
Well, you're absolutely right. One of the neat things about reuse models is we have a sense of, you know, what comes back. And so in the online systems, you can turn on a function that allows your empty product, you know, let's say your empty Tropicana, to trigger an order of a new one. And that is incredibly convenient for consumers because they don't have to worry about ever buying their orange juice again, nor do they have to worry about having too much, which is one of the challenges with traditional subscription models, that it's like a box every month. And then if you've turned on your orange juice and locked in the Tropicana, the chances of you staying with that brand are, of course, elevated, and that's good business for the companies who adopt it.
What is the biggest challenge for you in all of this, though? I mean, we've talked about a lot of the different things that make it difficult to change consumer behavior, to change something that people have been doing forever and make them do something different. But what's the biggest one for you? What's the biggest hurdle?
You know, with Loop, it's a reimagination of the entire way products are made. So I think there's like an inertia challenge where, you know, companies, when they develop these packages, have to invest quite a lot of resource to develop them and then build the entire operational capability to be able to fill them and have them go around. Those, you know, are quite big challenges to surmount. And then when it comes to the consumer, the biggest thing we've learned is that we, and I say this even as myself, really, as consumers, we prefer things that are cheap and convenient. And so for us to scale, what we've realized is the easier we make Loop and the more it feels like disposability, the more it will succeed. And so we're really trying to make it feel like, hey, you can just throw out your container when you're done. Don't even have to clean it. You're just throwing it into a reuse bin at the end and not a garbage bin. The part I'm optimistic about is disposability has only been around for 70 years. So I think there's a really good opportunity to look into our past, look for the wisdom in the past, but then to think about how to modernize it and make it something that really is 21st century.
That is Tom Zaki, and we will link you to more about Loop at hereandnow.org. Tom, thank you.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was great to chat, and look forward to chatting again sometime.
And Loop plans to start testing its products in Paris, London, and parts of the northeastern United States in May. You can see what these containers look like at hereandnow.org. Well, as people like Tom Zaki try to bring us into the future, Native Alaskans are sticking with traditions that have been around for generations. On the far northern coast of Alaska, preparations for spring whaling are in high gear. That includes making a traditional thread called evalu from caribou tendons, which are used to sew together the seal skin boats, which are basically canoes that can slide on the ice. Ravenna Koenig of Alaska's Energy Desk takes us to an evalu workshop.
Diana Martin is the first to arrive at the Inupiat Heritage Center for an evalu workshop that will be going on most of the day.
I have my sinews on the floor because they need to stay cool.
So you've got a plastic bag, and what is that?
It's caribou tendons. They need to be splitted, prepared to make strands.
The work actually started months ago, collecting tendons from family members who brought home caribou to eat. The tendons had to be dried outside in the cold for several weeks. Now, they almost look like stalks of a plant, beige and kind of stringy. They crunch when you split them apart. After they're split, the strands will be braided into thread. This whole process takes a ton of time and energy. One skin boat can require over 50 tendons. And some years, there are a lot of boats to make thread for.
At one time, there were 17 that were sewn in one spring.
Five of Martin's 12 siblings are whaling captains. So for the past 2 decades, she's had her hands full almost every year making sinew thread for their skin boats. She also lends a hand to other captains when they ask her. She's one of the teachers at today's workshop.
Hi, Nancy. Hi.
The other is Nancy Levitt, an elder and a whaling captain's wife. So, workshops like this one have been held for the past few years to teach others how to make the thread.
We learn how to split the sinew. We learn how to clean it for the ladies who would like to learn.
Levitt says the splitting stage is especially difficult because the tendons are tough. Sometimes it takes two people to pull them apart.
It builds up your muscles. It's like you go to the gym, except your arms work a lot and your feet work a lot. If you can't pull it with your hands, you put it on your like this and you pull it.
Levitt steps on one part of the tendon and uses her arms to work on splitting a part of it away. She actually enjoys the work, in part because it's so all-consuming.
Everything just falls into place. The problems, the stress, the thoughts you have, most of them just disappear.
And all the effort pays off when whaling crews get home safely with a new season of whale to feed the community. For Here and Now, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik.
Oregon's new first-in-the-country statewide rent control law was signed last week and is now in effect. It caps rent increases to around 7% plus inflation, with buildings below a certain size exempt, as is new construction. Oregon's Governor Kate Brown said the law will give immediate relief to Oregonians struggling to keep up with rising rents. Well, maybe some immediate relief, but what happens long term? Not everyone agrees. Rebecca Diamond is associate professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. She researches rent control and joins us now. Professor Diamond, Rebecca, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I have a guess that what you're going to tell us about this research, this irrefutable crunching of numbers, isn't going to be popular with a lot of people who believe that, of course, rent control is good because we see how rents are just skyrocketing in cities, and this will enable more people to live in places they can afford. I mean, that is the thinking, right?
So I think the research does support in the short term, right when rent control laws come in, those initial renters, they are helped. You know, the level of rent increase is limited. It enables people to stay in their home. But in the long run is when you start to really worry about rent control and think about how landlords might try to recoup some of these rental losses that rent control takes away from them. And that can really undermine rent control in the long run.
Well, as you say, in the long run, rent control decreases affordability, fuels gentrification, creates negative externalities on the surrounding neighborhood. So start with, you were talking about, you know, property owners who have long said when they protest rent control that if I can't raise my rents, I can't afford to take care of property, I'm going to turn around and sell it and take it off the market. Do you find that that's what happens?
So when we studied this in the context of San Francisco, that's exactly what we saw. Landlords are going to find uses of their property that are more profitable than rentals, and that's going to lead to less rental supply.
Yeah. Well, talk about some of the other effects because, you know, rent control, as we said, again, it's about affordability. People, it's been called insurance for people. They can invest in a community because they know that their rent isn't going to skyrocket. So they become a big part of the community, send their children to school, participate. And that's what advocates of rent control have always pointed to.
You're right. It's insurance for those people who get access to rent control right away. But as the landlords start taking their properties off the rental market, there's going to be even less supply of rental housing that's affordable. And then the shortage of rental housing will just get worse. And when there's a shortage, that drives up market rent. So you end up actually getting higher rental rates when you initially move into an apartment because there's just less housing to go around.
Well, and then there's the other element of rent control that people may know about anecdotally. Yes, we may know people who could not afford to be in, you know, certain neighborhoods if they didn't have a cap on the rent, but people abuse it.
So I think a great thing to consider with rent control is to note that it's for everyone. It's not targeted at the people who have, you know, really tight affordability constraints. If you're a high-income earner, you still get rent control. So you could imagine there are ways to improve a policy that could still make affordable housing available to a more financially needy population without expanding it to everyone.
Well, as you say, rent control leads to mismatches between tenants and rental units. Somebody may secure a rent-controlled unit and then never leave it.
That's exactly right. You face this trade-off if you've been in an apartment for a long time. Maybe you have a child now or you have a spouse and you need an extra bedroom, but you may not move and get that correct type of housing because you don't want to give up your rent control. So that ends up putting people in the wrong types of housing in the long run.
Yeah. Then what is the solution to these serious housing crunches in places like Oregon? They have people living in tents and in cars. What is a solution if not capping the rent so that they can live there?
So I see that there's a short-run solution and a long-run solution. And the long-run solution is a fundamental need of more supply of rental housing. So easing land use restrictions that make it easier for developers to supply that affordable housing and not make it so expensive to comply with all of the local regulations to build that housing is the real long-run solution. In the short run, you could imagine policies like rent control may be the Band-Aid that you need, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have to force that subsidy payment right directly onto landlords.
In other words, allow landlords to raise the rents as, you know, hopefully not gouging, but in ways that they feel make it worth it for them to have the rental units and not take them off the market, but provide deserving tenants with some sort of subsidy to be able to pay those rents.
Exactly, because when you do these types of subsidies through a more traditional government channel, then you can do things like condition them on being low income or condition them on other characteristics of the household, which we do for many other programs, and actually tie the subsidy to people who need it the most.
Yeah. And meanwhile, you mentioned land use, loosening restrictions on land use, and that's a huge issue in Oregon where, you know, keeping land open is a part of the character of the state. And so, you know, building more affordable housing is a big challenge there. Rebecca Diamond, associate professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, a researcher of rent control. I'm sure people are going to have a lot of opinions about your findings, Professor Diamond, but thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, Oregon becomes the first in the country with a statewide rent control law. Your thoughts welcome, herenow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.